Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Do Bristol's elite merchant venturers really give back to Bristol more than they take? I'm joined by the new master of the merchant venturers, Chris Curling. Bristol merchants financed John Cabot's 1497 trip to Newfoundland, which some cite as being the first European contact with the Americas, and went on to make money from the slave trade, where an estimated 4 million Africans altogether perished on the Middle Passage. During the colonisation of America, an estimated 12 million Native Americans died in what many regard as the greatest genocide or holocaust in human history. But now, we hope, anyway, they've changed their ways. The Merchant Venturers are a charitable organisation that gives much more back to Bristol, as our former Mayor George Ferguson says, than they take. I'm joined by Chris Curling, the new master of Bristol's Society of Merchant Venturers. But first, never mind Theresa May's stillborn child sexual abuse inquiry, which never seems to get off the ground. I'm joined on the line by Chris Stacey, who's from the People's Tribunal into Child Sexual Abuse. Hi, Chris, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me on.
Now, first of all, could you just tell us a little about your own experience and why you've got involved with the People's Tribunal?
Well, I'm a victim, or I call it a survivor, of child sex abuse myself by a person known to me when I was a child. And I was told that sort of thing was acceptable. I was brainwashed effectively, but as I came through into my 30s and 40s, I came to realise that there was something seriously wrong, and I've been making progress in getting out of that sort of situation. And now, seeing in the press and Tom Watson standing up in Parliament, I see that there's a lot been going on. I think a lot of us didn't know what was going on, but I feel that I can help do my little bit by helping others. So I've got involved with the UK Child Sex Abuse People's Tribunal.
Okay, now the first person to be put in charge was Elizabeth Butler Sloss. Also, another person put in charge of the official inquiry by Theresa May. Why is it that you don't feel that's working? Because, I mean, certainly it's no surprise to any of us that there's nobody actually seems to be in charge of the official inquiry. Is this one of the reasons why you've decided to go down the route of having one which is more organised by the victims rather than by the Home Secretary?
I guess it's to do with the fact that we are not, we don't have any links with any authorities or government. I mean, I wish the whole child sex abuse campaign in order to change the whole country and this country well, and whatever it takes. So if the authorities show more enthusiasm, then we wouldn't need to be doing this kind of job. So, whatever it takes, the People's Tribunal will have a panel led by Michael Mansfield and with John Cooper on board as well, who are eminent QCs, and they will have a look at and investigate widespread institutional abuse, as people will have seen in the press, and some leading MPs have also talked about it. So, Just getting it out there. Meanwhile, though, it doesn't stop people and survivors in particular coming forward and giving their evidence. They can come and talk to us, although we're not taking evidence at this stage. But it's giving survivors a voice, however it happens. And survivors, if they've got evidence, go to the police. It's quite obvious that when there's convictions, as in with that ex-DJ Ray Terrett, more people came out of the woodwork. So it's just one way of encouraging survivors to come forward and give evidence. But obviously the People's Tribunal ultimately is an investigation into what appears to be widespread institutional abuse and failure to stop it, and quite possibly sort of complicity in allowing it to happen. So that's where we're coming from, essentially.
Okay.
And I'm involved in building towards the main panel coming into place sometime next year. It's not going to be a quick sort of operation, but we have survivors on board, and we are very determined that we want to get to the truth. And if you get to the truth, you get rid of the rumours and some of the conspiracy theories about trying to make this country a better place, I think.
Okay. Tell us a bit more about Michael Mansfield and John Cooper, the two QCs which are going to be heading up this People's Tribunal.
They're both extremely eminent. They have experience of other people's tribunals to do with atrocities in Iran. The People's Tribunal is formed by the people and has no links to government or authorities. And it, although it has no legal power, it can make a statement and give a voice to the people, for the people that it's investigating on behalf of, for example, the victims or families of murdered Iranians during the 1980s. People may have heard of Michael Mansfield and John Cooper. John Cooper is regularly on LBC talking about issues and has a long history of successful cases. Michael Mansfield's been involved with a number of cases, including Jill Dando's murder, the miners' strike, and getting the miners off being charged to do with the Battle of Orgreave. The list of cases in his case, IRA, people being accused of IRA murders where they weren't actually involved. It just goes on and on. So two very eminent people, and a number of other people will be invited on this panel. And they will take the evidence, and they will I'm quite certain they will produce a very damning report at the end of it.
Okay, one of the most frustrating things about this, of course, is that we keep hearing about people like Cyril Smith and Jimmy Savile till the cows come home. They're dead. What about the prospect of possibly arresting, putting on trial some living child sexual abusers who are on this list of prominent people? Because I can imagine for you and others, it has a very, very terrible effect when there's this impunity, when abusers are left for years and years without actually ever having their collars felt at all by the police. That must have a pretty awful effect on the victims.
Yeah, absolutely. And and it also for everybody. I mean, it's not just the victims feeling bad about it, and it's whether the people in power, the paedophiles who have power, they may be high profile or they may not be. This kind of project that the People's Tribunal is looking to help, not just child sex abuse victims, but also it may well have an effect on the institutions and the vacuum, maybe even the political vacuum that exists at the moment. So I'm well aware that organisations like Exaro News are taking evidence and producing stories which end up in the mainstream media, and the police are investigating living high-profile figures, but all too slowly. And for, as a victim, I have a problem, or survivor, I have a problem with trust. So I want these the charges to happen as soon as possible. And I think everybody does, with their cynicism about people in positions of power. It's not everybody in positions of power, but it makes the whole system smell. You know, there are, believe it or not, good politicians out there and good people in authority, but they can't do their job properly if they've got some people who shouldn't be in public life and should be being charged, personally, I think.
Is there any reason why you think that people in high office have been... is there any kind of sort of centre of power where people who maybe should have been being charged haven't? Because this seems to be the biggest problem is if you've got somebody, say, for example, as a Home Secretary, if they're supposed to be doing the investigating, but actually they're involved in abuse in some way, how do we get over this?
I think it's a massive cat's cradle. It's not everybody. Some people would, some other people in high powers will turn a blind eye because they're more interested in keeping their own position in power. I think you keep investigating, and most importantly, survivors out there, if you're listening, come forward and talk to somebody that you trust. You can come and talk to us, or go to XRO News, or any organisation out there, or go and talk to the police with support, because the more evidence is out there, the more chance there is of people in high-profile paedophiles or low-profile paedophiles prosecuted and being brought to justice. As a survivor myself, come forward.
I'm sure some people will. How do people get in touch with the People's Tribunal, Chris? I know you said that they'll be at least starting your work really in the new year, but you're interested initially to make initial contacts with anybody who feels they've got a raw deal, having come forward before or have never come forward before. How do people get in touch?
Well, we've got a website which we've just launched, which is www.thepeoplestribunal.org.uk, and on there there's a contact a page, and survivors can email in on survivorsupport@thepeoplestribunal.org.uk, or it's easy findable on Google. So, and it's up and working, and we have people who will respond to survivors, and they are survivors themselves, so they know what they're talking about.
Okay, it's Chris Stacey from the People's Tribunal into Child Sexual Abuse. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show today.
Well, thanks very much, Tony, for having me on.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
And that website again was thepeoplestribunal.org.uk. No doubt they'll have a phone number when they start hearing evidence, etc., next year. Anyway, I'm joined now by the new master of the Merchant Venturers. That is Chris Curling. I announced you at the top of the hour, Chris, saying that Bristol merchants originally discovered America, but that was before the Merchant Venturers were formed, I believe.
Yeah, it was the best part of 70 or 80 years before we were formed. Although it is fair to say that there were predecessor bodies to the Merchant Venturers who were around at that time, and indeed well before 1497, who were involved in all sorts of different things, and the Cabot expedition is an example of those.
Now, what about the controversy recently, though? Because we had the Bishop of Bristol, Mike Hill, giving a speech to you and some of your children at your various schools that you're in charge of. I think it was Colson Girls School and the Merchants Academy, where he was throwing into question this whole business of Edward Colston, the former merchant venturer, and his involvement in the slave trade, saying that actually his business dealings, the questions over his business dealings, were speculation. Now, is that something you'd go along with as well?
Well, I was, as you say, at that service, and what I heard the bishop say was that there was speculation around the morality of Colston's business dealings, or some of them anyway. The bishop did not mention slavery in what he said. But if you're asking me the question, do I think that Colston would have been involved in slavery, I would have to say that it was more than likely. As it happens, his family business, which he inherited, was based around the import of wine, oil, and fruit from Spain and Mediterranean countries. But I think that there are various bits of circumstantial evidence which would suggest, although not proved, but would suggest that he probably had some involvement in the slave trade, which, of course, at that time was legal and not even regarded as immoral. It seems extraordinary today that that would be the case, because, of course, we all regard slavery as utterly abhorrent. But that was the way it was at the time.
Well, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, we had a report out in the newspapers, London newspapers here, about modern slavery in Britain, saying they reckon that there's 30,000 people still involved in modern slavery in Britain.
In Britain, that is absolutely right. And
people trafficking, this kind of thing.
And we know that there are several hundred of those in and around Bristol. And I heard on the radio the other day that the current level of trade in modern slavery worldwide produces an annual profit of £150 billion a year. It is a massive problem and a massive issue these days, not least right here in our backyard in Bristol.
Okay, so the Merchants Venture has actually got their... You got your charter back in 1552. But doing a bit of research into you, looking at the articles that Rich Cookson did back about 10 years ago, looking at power in the city, one of the things he found out was that the Merchant Ventures don't have to file for the Merchant Ventures themselves accounts at Companies House. But although there are some accounts filed... they are for subsidiary companies of the Merchant Ventures. So it seems like a bit of a mysterious organisation. How much money do the Merchant Ventures really have, and what are your investments?
We are far less wealthy than would be commonly assumed. And the reason for that is that we have responsibility for a number of trusts, two or three of which are really very significant. That is not our money, but it is capital which the Society of Merchant Venturers manages for very specific causes. We have a charitable fund of our own, which gives out into the local community about £250,000 a year. And in fact, over the last 5 years, we have given money to something like 150 different local charitable activities around the greater Bristol region.
But you can see why people question this whole thing that George Ferguson, the former Merchant Venturer, now the mayor, was saying about that. Oh, the Merchant Venturers, they put far more into the city than they take out. If you're not absolutely open about what those investments are, people are going to start asking questions, aren't they? I mean, like me, for example, about where those investments are. I mean, for example, in the oil industry. I mean, I know he found that you had a lot of shares in Shell Oil, for example, other utility companies, banks, that kind of thing. People start to ask, well, hang on a minute, every time I fill up my petrol tank, a little bit of money's going to the Merchant Venturers. Every time I pay my water bill, a little bit of money's going to the Merchant Venturers. And I know you're also a director, one of the directors of Bristol Water. So electricity as well. Do you have finance? Do you have investments in there?
Well, if we had no investments in any of that list of sectors that you've mentioned, I'm not quite sure where we would end up. I'm an environmental campaigner. I would not myself want to have shares in certain sectors, but the reality is that if you're saying that one shouldn't have shares in banks and one shouldn't have shares in electricity companies, I must say I find that a pretty odd proposition.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is, for example, if I've got... I mean, it's about the rich and the poor, really, is what I'm saying. Is, say, for example, if I've got £20,000 to invest, say, for example, in, I don't know, North West Water or Southern Electricity or whatever, then I can easily find that my share dividends will just pay my bills forever, and I've got a nice little nest egg. So, effectively, what's happening is people who are wealthy are simply not paying any bills, but those who are poor are paying for them.
That proposition assumes that in some rather bizarre way, the Society of Merchant Venturers or its members personally are benefiting from these investments. But as I have just told you, we are giving the income from this endowment that we have to the charitable causes right throughout the city. How you can argue that is the rich sort of keeping for the rich, goodness only knows.
Well, I mean, aren't most of the Merchant Venturers, if not all of them, all independently wealthy anyway?
No, that is not the case. The Merchant Venturers are a group of about 75 people who are drawn mainly from across the business and indeed the wider community. And some of them, of course, are wealthy. Some of them have been very successful in business and have done extremely well. But that is not right across the piece by any means.
And what about arms firms? Do you invest in arms firms or not?
In what?
Arms firms. Arms companies.
I'm not that I'm aware of, no. I wouldn't be able to answer that specifically.
Surely, as the master, you've got some kind of knowledge of which shares that the merchants are invested in.
What I am concerned about and engaged in as master is the pursuit of the various activities that the society is engaged in for the benefit of the wider community. And that is, frankly, a broad spectrum which ranges from concern with youth and young people in our extensive education activity, through to the community funding that I've already mentioned, through to social business and social enterprise, which we're supporting, and then particularly into the care of the elderly. Through the work which we do in looking after directly and indirectly some 1,500 elderly people in this city who need different types of care, whether it be the most likely sheltered or right through to state-of-the-art dementia units.
So are you saying effectively that where the cuts are biting, that the LibCon Alliance nationally is forcing local authorities to roll back things like elderly care, youth work, that the merchant ventures are taking over?
We are doing our bit to help. I see that you have a smile on your face, and I think that that is an entirely appropriate reaction to your own question.
So you're doing some work, but are you able to actually do any more? Because a lot of people are looking around the city when, I mean, for example, there's a respite care centre called the Bush Residential Care Home, which the local authority is having to actually cut back, halving the amount of care they're able to give there. Are people like the merchants able to pick up the ball and run with it?
Well, we are doing that, and we're doing what we can. And I think the thrust of your question is absolutely right, that there is massive need out there. And the Society of Merchant Venturers today is a group of 75 people who I would have to say I would describe as can-do people in the main, who are doing what they can to address a set of what you rightly describe as very big issues.
So what's your analysis of the sort of macroeconomics here? Because we're looking at a situation back in 2008. We had a massive bailout for the banks, didn't we? Some of which you may have shares in. And many would say, actually, what we should have done was to just let those banks go bust, and then the public would not have spent £750 billion keeping them going when they're effectively, you know, a lot of people would say zombie banks. Do you think that was the right decision to make back in 2008, the bailout?
That's a question that, of course, has nothing to do with the merchant venturers whatsoever. So you're asking for my personal opinion on that. And I think that it is a moot point as to whether the policy that was adopted at that time, which extends not only to the bailing out of the banks, but also, of course, to this massive quantitative easing that has then been conducted by the Bank of England subsequently, I think it's a moot point as to whether that was an appropriate policy. What, of course, we don't know is what the negative impacts would have been from taking an alternative course of action. And the argument at the time, and I'm not an economist, so I'm not in a position to make an informed view about it, but the argument at the time was that by failing to bail out the banks, we would have caused much greater social unrest and social discomfort.
It certainly would have been a lot of discomfort, but I mean, it probably would have hit rich people more than it would have hit poor people, because there's a you know, those who've got obviously got shares in the banks would have lost their money. But there's a sort of a bigger principle here in a way, isn't it? It's quite clearly, looking at those banks at the time back in 2008 and possibly now still, there are questions saying, well, hang on a minute, they're not actually running a viable business. Should we, the public, help them, or should we just allow that business to take its course? It's almost like, I suppose, a free market argument.
The too big to fail argument is an awful one, and I would have thought that few people would these days want to support and condone that argument. And indeed, a lot of steps have been taken by authorities to try to address that very issue should it arise again. And as I say, I think there would be few people who would want to embrace the too big to fail policy.
What about the too big to jail policy? Because a lot of people are saying that a lot of these banks, I mean, they've been doing things like money laundering, fixing the foreign exchange rates. No, none of the senior people in any of these banks have been arrested, prosecuted, or anything like that. It's all been out of court fines. What are your thoughts about whether that's appropriate?
This is purely a personal view, and we're now a million miles from the Society of Merchant Venturers, or indeed from any of the other activities in which I'm engaged. But if you want to pursue this line of argument, I would very much agree that it seems extremely odd. That individuals can be prosecuted and sent to jail for offences which one might legitimately say are far less in their intensity and severity of impact than what some of the bankers have been involved in.
So would you agree with that phrase, too big to jail? Do you think they were too big to jail?
I don't know whether they were too big to jail, but I suppose I find it quite surprising that people haven't taken action against, don't seem to have been able to take action against some of these individuals.
Yes, maybe we better put another call into the City of London Police. I'm not sure. Anyway, back to you, Chris. Tell us a bit about you as the master of the Merchant Ventures. What are your other roles, and where have you come from to the Merchants?
Okay. I'm an Essex boy, actually, by background. And I hitchhiked down here with my wife in 1974 to seek my fortune in the West Country. And just to be clear, I'm still seeking it. So in relation to your earlier comments. And I came down here and I joined a firm of lawyers, a small firm of lawyers. And we built up that firm from about 40 or 50 when I joined it to a point where 25 years later it had 800 people. I was a corporate finance lawyer and we became a corporate firm. We actually engaged in during that 25-year period in quite a lot of what you might laughingly describe as entrepreneurial activity, which you don't necessarily associate with lawyers. But nevertheless, there was a bit of enterprise in that. When I retired from that firm 10 years ago, having been one of two people running it for 15 years, we had 800 employees, and we had offices not only in Bristol but in London, in Germany, in Scandinavia, in Silicon Valley, and all over the place.
Crikey, who were they then?
Osmond Clark.
Oh, okay. And so you say you retired, but you're obviously quite active still, aren't
yeah.
you?
I retired at the age of 53 in order to pursue a series of business interests that I'd been developing in the previous few years. So to cut a long story short, I'm now the chairman of a small public company based in Milton Keynes, which is in the employee benefits business.
Who are they?
Employee benefits. It's a company called Personal Group. It's listed on the AIM market, and we go into very large companies like bus companies, logistics businesses, catering businesses, and we put in voluntary benefit schemes which give employees discounted rates on gym membership, on lifestyle things like holidays, etc. And we also have some simple healthcare insurance products there, which we insure ourselves. It's a very interesting, rather niche, but highly profitable and successful business. So I'm chairman of that. I'm a non-exec director, as I think you've already said, of Bristol Water. I'm involved with a technology startup business in London, which is digitizing coupons. So instead of having a piece of paper that says 4p off Persil, you'll be able to go into the supermarket and it will all appear in your smartphone in a wonderful way. And so that is my paid work. And then I determined when I left Osborne Clark 10 years ago that I would spend half my life working in the voluntary sector. And so I am the chairman of the cycling and walking charity Sustrans. I have been chairman of the biodiversity conservation charity Wildscreen, which takes Bristol's position as the wildlife and natural history film capital of the world. And it's a sort of shop window, if you like, for that. So we have the most important trade fair in the world in this genre, which takes place in Bristol every 2 years. I've been involved with the on the Council of Bristol University and with the Environmental Institute there, which is called the Cabot Institute. More recently, through my merchant venture connection, I've been chairman of the governors of the Academy School in Withywood, which is called Merchants Academy.
Crikey, quite a lot, actually. Let's just talk about Bristol Water, because it's been in the news today, the national news, Bristol Water, as actually getting its knuckles wrapped as the worst company, water company in the country, if you're looking at overcharging, because you've been ordered at Bristol Water to cut bills by 21% over the next 5 years. I looked at the Ofwat press release, and they're basically saying, and I think, I don't know if you'd agree with me, but they're saying that what you've been doing is at Bristol Water is shifting costs from the big clients and the wholesale market in water onto individuals and households. And so you're going to have to do the opposite, shift them back again, and that means that you're going to have to be taking quite a lot off of everybody's individual water bills at Bristol Water. It's not great, is it, to be pointed to by Ofwat as the water company that's overcharging the most and going to have to cut your rates the most out of anywhere in the country?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I'm not a spokesman for Bristol Water, therefore I'm going to be limited in what I'm willing to say about this. However, I think that your description of what you're saying off what is said is at best a distortion, and at worst something very considerably different from that. What I would say is this: that the prices that the water companies, like any other utility, can charge are fixed every 5 years, and this is what is happening now. The prices were fixed through the same regulatory system 5 years ago. So to suggest that we have been overcharging for the last 5 years, which is not what have done, is simply not right. What, however, fundamentally the point is this: that there is a balance that has to be struck between what customers pay and the level of service and the resilience of the distribution network, the pipes and the mains and the treatment works and the reservoirs and all the rest of it. And there's a balance to be struck between what customers pay and the level of service and resilience and the need to maintain an appropriate level of resilience of the system. And in the course of the preparation of our business plan over the last 2 years and more, we have worked very, very closely indeed with a customer group that has been drawn widely across our customer base. It includes representatives from organisations like Citizens Advice Bureau and the Consumer Council for Water, local authority councillors, etc. And they approved our plan unanimously. They have been very supportive of our plan. And in surveys more widely across our customer base, we have had 92% approval and acceptance of our plan. And so in a sense, we have here a pretty significant disconnect between what we, supported by our customers through their representatives, feel is appropriate for the next 5 years, and what Ofwat, who apply a consistent financing model across the industry, which benefits some companies and does the opposite for other companies, what they say we should be charging.
So you're saying Ofwat's got it wrong?
What I am saying is that our plan was put together with strong approval from our customers, and not only that, but having had civil engineers and accountants and professionals of all sites and types and persuasions looking at our plans, looking at our costings, and giving us the comfort that what we submitted has been a sound and appropriate business plan.
Yeah, interesting that should just come out today. I wonder what your thoughts are about whether you think it's appropriate to be running things like these utilities like water as a private business, or whether you think it would be better run as the old water boards used to be, in state hands, because essentially, you know, those days and those ways of doing things were done for a reason, and that was that that the water should be supplied to people at cost. And what it seems here is that in any private business, there's bound to be payments made to shareholders or to staff, and it's going to be more expensive in the private sector. So why not just go back to the old system where water's being supplied to people at cost?
Well, because if you look at the state of the, just to take the water industry, if you look at the state of the water industry as it was immediately before privatisation and the state that it's in today, it is in an immeasurably stronger condition, by which I mean that the resilience, the reliability, the quality of service, and reflected, of course, by the huge amount of capital that has been invested since privatisation in the infrastructure of the water industry, the customers who benefit from the water industry have benefited enormously from privatisation. And let's not remember that where you talk about the level of profit that is available to shareholders, that level of profit is itself stipulated by Ofwat. And so that is in the overall mix when Ofwat sets its prices.
But what about, I think it's a PLC, isn't it, Bristol Water? But it doesn't, I don't think you can get shares on the open market, can you? So who are your shareholders?
Well, it was a public company. When I first became a director, it was a public company with many shareholders. It was then the subject of a takeover bid, it is rather strange on the surface that our shareholders now are a Canadian infrastructure fund, a Spanish water company, and even a Japanese conglomerate has a small shareholding. But I have to say that I speak as one of the independent non-executive directors, of whom there are three. The shareholders are a, if you like, a beneficent group of shareholders. They have concerns, particularly for the standards and levels of service that we offer, and of course they need to make their return on capital. But if you think that the board meetings are dominated by discussion of shareholder interests, you could not be further from the truth.
But I mean, surely there's pressure on you around the board table at Bristol Water to be thinking, well, hang on a minute, we better make sure that we keep the shareholders happy. And the customers, ordinary people like us, like me, Martin, and everybody.
And me. And you.
Surely,
and I am,
surely
I,
they come secondary, don't
no,
they?
No. Absolutely not. That is absolutely not the case, and that is why the water companies all have independent non-executive directors like me. But what I'm saying is that the job which the three independent non-executives have on the board of Bristol Water, in terms of protecting and ensuring that the rights of the customer are protected, that is not a difficult role for us to discharge, because the shareholders understand very well that the position of the customer is paramount.
Well, let's hope they do.
They do. Well, I can assure you, I can absolutely assure you they do.
Yeah, because, I mean, for example, if the customer can't afford to pay the bills, then the shareholder's going to have to take a hit, aren't they?
And there are extensive arrangements in place for dealing with exactly that eventuality. So I mean, we know that some customers have difficulty paying, and where there are genuine cases of customers who are genuinely unable to pay, as opposed to people who simply don't pay for whatever reason, there are support mechanisms, and I mentioned just now the Citizens Advice Bureau. That is one of the mechanisms which are deployed with funding support from the company to assist those very people.
So you're not in favour of going back to a water board?
No, I'm not, because I'm saying that the capital that has been invested since privatisation and the ongoing requirements, I think I'm right in saying that the figure for the next 5 years is £44 billion that will need to be invested in the next 5 years. That sort of money can only come from private sources.
And can we and you look forward to a 21% cut in our water bills?
That remains to be seen. But clearly, in the course of the coming weeks, the company will need to consider whether an appeal is appropriate.
Well, we'll wait and see. Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about this? Because in a way, it's one of the most fundamental of all the privatisations over the decades has been water. Do you think it's worked?
Well, I mean, I'm ideologically opposed to private water, so therefore we're on opposite sides of the fence there. But there's no point picking that up in one sense. It is a private company. That's how it's being run. I did find it very strange, though. For example, in Wessex Water, it turned out that they'd been bought out by Enron, who were actually turned out to be a non-company invented by geeks in Texas. And that's what we're talking about here is water in the West Country, and it's suddenly we're found ourselves caught up in all of that sort of thing. And of course we do have an alternative model in Scotland. For example, the water boards still exist. It's Scottish Water, owned by the people of Scotland. And of course the other thing is that when the privatisations took place, Birmingham City Council weren't very happy because they'd created their own water infrastructure, which were then absorbed into the nationalised water industry and then privatised. And Birmingham City Council saying, hang on a minute, that's our water, but that's how we created that. I mean, a lot of utilities historically were created by the entrepreneurialism of municipal elected officials, not through individual entrepreneurialism. So Chamberlain, who used to run Birmingham, created the gas utility and the water boards and so on, and he did it as a public enterprise rather than as a private enterprise. But anyway, those are
but actually the Bristol Water. Going back to the 1840s and 1850s, that was created originally by a set of private entrepreneurs.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a different history in each case,
yeah,
isn't
indeed.
I thought it was created by the monks back in medieval times with their conduits bringing the water into the city centre.
Ah, well, that's that is absolutely right. I don't think it was the monks so much as Sir Robert de Berkeley. Who owned the estates around here, and you're probably aware that there is the original source of clean water into Bristol came down from Knowle,
of all places,
and even today there is a pipe and the signs above ground of the pipe that runs from a source in Knowle into a well beside St Mary Redcliffe Church.
And then it's also St John's Conduit, and I noticed a couple of years ago, in fact, that had been running for 700 years, and I was horrified to see there was some Bristol Water Works going on in the city centre, at which point the conduit stopped working, and it's never worked since. So I'm not saying definitely that was your Bristol Water Company that stopped it, but it had been going for 700 years beforehand. Don't you think we should have a look at that, at getting that back going again?
Well, I don't know about that one, but what I can tell you is this, that in relation to the pipe that comes down from Knowle and goes into a well, a sink at St Mary Redcliffe, it goes through Bedminster. And during the war, some bomb damage was caused in Bedminster to the pipe. And our people at Bristol Water, on a voluntary basis, have been looking at the damage caused there and have been taking action about it. So, we're doing something about that.
Over in Ireland, in Dublin this week, we've had one of the biggest protests for years over water, because they're having to pay for water for the first time in Ireland. For you, I mean, you must be looking across the Irish Sea thinking, crikey, well, we hope we don't have that sort of protest against our charging for water over here. Because, I mean, in a way, we are looking at water as a sort of natural resource and as something which, well, the Irish people certainly think they should never have to pay for.
No, but my understanding is that the Irish have understood and presumably been told for generations that the cost of their water is part of their overall taxes, and that they are therefore paying for their water through the through their taxation.
Well, we could do that here, surely.
Well, you could do, but that is not the system that is adopted in this country.
Martin, don't you think it makes sense to take some of these very basic fundamental requirements that everybody needs, the poor and the rich alike, and to deliver them to the public through taxation? Isn't that what taxation is?
Well, I would obviously argue that as a socialist, but I mean, water is becoming a very sensitive issue all over the world. The attempts to privatise water in Bolivia, for example, in La Paz, caused a massive social uprising, and they were actually trying to say to people, you must buy water from the privatised water company, we won't even let you collect rainwater. So they're going around kicking over people's...
I don't think we're quite like that here.
No, but and also in Detroit, there's big protests at the minute of people, poor people, being cut off their water supplies. And, you know, water is a rather special... I mean, we all need a certain amount of water every day. We're not talking here about a choice that consumers can choose to have or not to have. We all need it. And, of course, that's the reason why there's a strong public interest in this industry, whether it's in public or private hands. It's got to be regulated, as you've rightly said. It's not just a free-for-all, is it?
No, absolutely not. But the fact is that it is very, very easy to take the provision of clean water coming through your tap every day for granted. Oh. And the price which is paid by customers for the water coming through the tap every day is a very, very modest level in comparison with costs of other drinks and indeed other utilities.
The most, I think, probably we've been talking about water for a long, long time around this table. But there's one other way we have, and that's through fracking. What's your thoughts about that, Chris? As someone that sits around the board table at Bristol Water, we've heard that that fracking in other parts of the world, certainly in other parts of in the United States and Australia, etc., has actually adversely affected our water supplies. Is that something you're worried about?
Yeah, it's that is something I am worried about. I suppose when I think about fracking, I tend to put on my Sustrans and my environmental hat, and fracking is being portrayed as a potentially wonderful solution to all sorts of our economic problems. But we must remember that fracking involves the use of fossil fuels. Fracking is a producer of fossil fuels, and anything that is contributing to the burning of fossil fuels, in my book, is a bad thing.
Well, I'm also thinking about the injection of chemicals into the aquifers.
Absolutely.
And in the Mendips, for example. And I know you, for example, you've got a reservoir at Cheddar, haven't
you? Yep. I mean, we are very concerned about that. And you may possibly be aware that there was an issue not very long ago involving a quarry at Stowey, where there was a planning application in to dump toxic waste in this quarry, which was above the Chew Valley Reservoir, and Bristol Water were quite rightly very concerned about that, and I'm sure that we would have similar concerns in relation to fracking.
Okay, back to the Merchant Venturers now. Chris Curling's joining me, who's the new, just installed last month, Master of the Merchants. What is your role as Master? What do you do?
As Master, I suppose I'm the lead custodian of the activities, if you like, of the society. I'm the principal spokesperson and the principal representative. So I attend quite a lot of different functions, but most particularly of all, I am concerned to make sure that the range of activities which we carry on in the community are being properly and fully discharged, and that where there is opportunity to do more, we can evaluate those opportunities, and I want to make the most of the resources that we have, particularly the human resources that we have, in order to be able to discharge to the greatest benefit possible the various things that we do. And I have a particular interest in two aspects. One is communications. I think it is fair to say that the society, although it is it's opened itself up enormously in the last 8 or 10 years, and is in a very different place. It's a very different organisation from what it is 10 years ago. Nevertheless, it perhaps has has not been as open and communicative about the activities that it engages in as it should have been. Now, there's a very good reason for that, and that is that there has been an approach to date, which I think is very laudable, which says that we should be concentrating all our firepower and all our resources on the activities that we do, rather than explaining to the community around us what it is that we are doing. And I think that the time has now come when we need to just spend a bit of resource in explaining to the world outside what we're doing, which is actually why I'm delighted to have been asked to come on this programme.
Great. Well, maybe again sometime, Chris, because, I mean, when you're talking about communications, obviously the big problem that you've got from a PR point of view is the links to the slave trade. And I was on the board of the Bristol Cultural Development Partnership up in the run-up to 2007 and 2008, and the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade. And I just felt at the time, through seeing the surveys that were being done around the city about people's consciousness of the slave trade and slavery generally, the one thing that kept coming back was that particularly the Afro-Caribbean community, but many people in St. Paul's and other people in the black minority ethnic community, wanted to see some kind of permanent memorial in the city, whether it be a museum or something like that, which was not necessarily something created by the Merchant Venturers, which the Merchant Venturers were behind, that would put, I suppose, an end to the speculation, if you want, that the Merchant Venturers aren't taking those historical problems seriously. And I just wonder what you think about that, because nothing seems to have happened, and there's various... nobody's basically come up with any money to do it, I suppose that's why, or a space to do it in, and I'm sure the City Council would help find somewhere. But is that something you're in favour of, having some sort of permanent, museum, looking at some of the warts and all, at some of the crimes, really, that we can look back on now? Because it wasn't a crime at the time, but quite clearly, morally, it was a crime to be involved in that trade, and it's something where previous merchants in previous generations actually did rather well out of it.
Yes, I might take you back to your very introduction at the beginning of this programme, because you seemed to be saying two things. First of all, that the society itself benefited enormously from slavery. That is not true. The society did not engage in slavery, although certainly some of its members did engage in slavery and would have benefited. But the key thing is that they were not the only people in Bristol who benefited from it, and that's the other issue that I think you got wrong, if I might say so, in your introduction. It is wrong to focus the slave trade only on people who were merchant venturers, and that is because Bristol people, much more widely than just the merchant venturers, were involved in the slave trade.
Well, to be fair, Chris, I haven't actually said that. I mean, what I'm focusing on is Edward Colston specifically. That's what we were focusing on, and he was a merchant venturer and he was a slave trader.
Yes, he was, I would repeat what I said earlier, that that nobody in their right minds today would regard slavery historically, and indeed modern slavery, as anything other than completely abhorrent. Of course, Edward Colston was also arguably Bristol's greatest benefactor in terms of the amount of money that he put into the Bristol community, many people over the last 200 or 300 years have benefited considerably from that.
But in a way,
that is not to say that I would regard Edward Colston as having been a man of unblemished character.
But let me
just repeat again to get the context right. At that time, slavery was legal, and it was not regarded as immoral.
But it's also quite legal now to have investments in arms companies, isn't it?
Yes,
so
it is.
Don't you think that maybe it would be helpful for the society to be more open about where it has its investments? It's certainly spending money in the city through charitable means, which is very laudable. But don't you think there are questions about where that money's coming from?
Frankly, I would regard that as an absolute sideshow. I think what is much more important is the fact that we are managing investments which are producing income, which is coming into the community across a very wide piece.
Are you doing well out of the financial crisis as investors? Because what's happening is the quantitative easing money seems to be finding its way into the stocks and shares investment markets, but not finding its way into the real world. So it's actually quite good for big investors like yourselves.
You're asking whether we've done well out of the financial crisis. I think that in common with many other investors, we've had our ups and we've had our downs over the period. I don't see that is a question that is particularly relevant, frankly, to what we're up to in terms of our community work in this current day and age.
But most of that QE money does go into stocks and shares and asset prices and things like that, doesn't it?
It goes into all sorts of places, but that may be the case, yes.
What about your Latin motto, in pauperiem pati? What does that mean? And I mean, because certainly when I put it into, first of all, looked it up in my Latin dictionary, it says the poor are stupid and long-suffering. What's your translation of it? Because that's what my Latin dictionary says, and what a computer dictionary told me.
Well, first of all, you haven't quoted the Latin correctly. You should have added the word indoculus in at the front of it.
Oh, sorry.
That is apparently taken from some ode of Horace, who was a Latin poet. Horace.
Horace.
Yeah. And what it translates as is, it is intolerable to allow poverty. And what that is about is the philanthropic work of the society, which is about the relief of poverty.
And do you think you're succeeding?
Well, we've got one hell of a task, and all I can tell you is that we've got 75 pretty can-do people who are working very, very hard across the range of community areas that I've talked about.
Okay, thanks very much. That's Chris Curling, Master of the Merchant Ventures, talking to us there. We're back this week. You'll find this show online at www.thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, dozens of flights have been cancelled and many others delayed after a technical failure at the headquarters of air traffic control company NATS in Hampshire. For a time, there were no flights able to take off or land at some UK airports, but the problem was resolved by around 4 p.m. Transport Secretary Patrick McLaughlin says the disruption was unacceptable. Martin Rolfe from the National Air Traffic Control Service insists they responded quickly.
Obviously, we apologise to any passenger that's been disrupted, and obviously our customers in the form of the airlines and the airports as well. But from our perspective, we're now back up and running, working very closely with our partners, the airlines and the airports, to make sure that the entire system can get up and back to normal as fast as is humanly possible.
Ministers have been warned urgent actions needed to get the NHS through the winter after waiting times in A&E in England hit record levels. Figures for the first week of December show more than 35,000 people waited more than 4 hours for treatment. UKIP isn't commenting on reports it's getting £300,000 donation from newspaper proprietor Richard Desmond. The owner of The Express, Star and several magazines is believed to have met Nigel Farage earlier this month. It's claimed lightning has struck 5,000 times across the Western Isles and northern Scotland in this